Welcome back to America's leading higher education podcast, The EdUp Experience, where we make education your business. Hosts Dr. Joe Salustio, Elizabeth Leiba, and producer Elvin Freites bring you the brightest and most influential minds in higher education today. We explore innovations, ideas, and issues in higher education and beyond, and hopefully have a little fun along the way. Now let's get to it.
Welcome back, everybody. This is the EdUp Experience, where we make education your business. My name is Elizabeth Leiba, and joining us today, we have Dr. Dwan Warmack. Dr. Warmack, how are you today?
I'm doing exceptionally well. How about yourself?
I'm doing amazing. I can't complain. It's been a busy day, but we're going to make things happen, and I'm excited to speak with you. I have a ton of questions and so much that I want to speak with you about. So I want to go ahead and launch into some of that conversation. But before I do, I wanted to just take a few minutes, and we always do at the beginning of the podcast conversation, just to ask you, you know, we're all going through some unprecedented times with COVID-19 and facing that as a struggle and trying to overcome that as a country. How are you doing? How is your health? How's your family, your coworkers there at Claflin University? How are things going for you?
Well, first off, thank you for having me on the podcast. I am both excited and delighted to be able to participate. I've had a chance to follow the work, and so just consider it as an honor to have be a part of the distinguished individuals that have participated in this podcast. We are, as you said, we're dealing with a interesting time, you know, as this COVID-19, and as we talk about this pandemic and how it has impacted not just this region, but the world. And, you know, we are making adjustments as needed. And our number one priority is, you know, just the health and the safety and the well-being of all the constituents we serve. And so that's just been our main focus, not wavering from that. And so that's been what we've been focused on. And personally as well, you know, with my family, and we are doing everything in our power to try to keep ourselves healthy and not losing faith. Our faith is so important to us. And so just keeping the faith and knowing that we're covered and doing the things that, you know, we need to do to try to maintain our health.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for addressing that. I'm glad to hear that everyone's doing well. So I guess to just continue on that vein of conversation, at your college, maybe give us a little bit of background as far as Claflin University, if there are those, which I'm sure anyone should not be able to say this, but if there are those that have not heard of you guys and the mission and what you're doing there at your university, give us a little bit of background. You are, I think when I was looking at the website and I was doing my research on just what the, some of the amazing things you're doing there, you are an amazing standout as the first HBCU, historically Black college university in South Carolina, top 10 HBCU. You've really been a trailblazer in your state as far as some of the programs and some of the initiatives you're doing there. So tell us a little bit about your mission, about maybe the history of the school founded in 1869 after the Civil War. There's just so much to unpack there, but give us a little bit of an overview about Claflin University. You joined as the president about, it looks like about, maybe about a year ago or so, if I'm not mistaken. So tell us a little bit about your school, and then, you know, in terms of COVID, how you're working to help to guide your university through these uncharted waters.
Well, once again, I think you you touched on a lot of it. Claflin University was founded in 1869, and what was most, you know, so we're the, you know, oldest HBCU in the state of South Carolina, and anyone who follows, you know, HBCU work and higher education knows South Carolina has in a variety of HBCUs that are here. And so, but being the first, and as you mentioned, we continue to be a thought leader. And as you think about COVID, if you think about the George Floyd situation, Black Lives Matter, you think about the historical context of Claflin, 1869, we were founded as an institution that was welcoming to anyone, regardless of race, religion, beliefs. And so you think before, diversity and inclusion had become a catch term, had become something of today's time. Over 150 years ago, that was the mission and the vision of this institution. So that's deeply rooted in our work that we do. And so the notion of social justice, equity, and inclusion is part of our mission, and we continue to focus on that. So our institution, and like you said, continues to be ranked in the top 10 amongst HBCUs in the nation. We have the highest alumni giving rate. You know, we hover annually about 40% of our alums give, which is historic for anyone, any type of institution in the country to have that much percentage of their alumni giving. It's part of the transformational experience that they have at this outstanding institution. You know, we are focused on preparing global visionary leaders, and that is infused into our curriculum, that is infused into our teaching, into our learning. So we're committed to that. You know, our students go on to do outstanding work, either graduate school, professional school, or whatever their endeavors are when they leave this institution. It is a jewel here on the Hilltop High in Orangeburg, South Carolina, where life-changing experiences happen from the inside out, you know, at our institution. And so we believe in developing a whole student that's academically, personally, socially, and spiritually. We're unapologetic about our faith, unapologetic about our founded history as an HBCU, and continue to be one of the thought leaders in that space. And so I'm excited to, in 151 years, to be the ninth president in school history. So that talks about sustained leadership, talks about institutions' commitment to longevity, and so to be the ninth president in 151 years it speaks volumes. And we're on an amazing trajectory, and we, as we talked about, the notion of social justice, inclusion, and as we're seeing what's happening with COVID, and there are certain communities and populations that's been significantly impacted more than others. And so as an African American community, we're seeing how this is impacting our community. And so we're taking steps. You know, we fundamentally believe is either you're part of the problem or part of the solution. And so we're in the process now of, you know, ensuring we're part of the solution. And so when this all hit, we have a very strong nursing program. And so, but we felt that there was a shortage of nursing, not just in the state of South Carolina, but globally. So we've just recently announced and approved through SACS, our accrediting body, a new online Master's of Nursing program that will have two different tracks, nurse practitioner portion and nurse education portion as well, to really fulfill the void that America is having around this healthcare profession. And so that's that. We have just announced a new Center for Social Justice that we're doing robust training, and we'll be offering culture competency training to multiple municipalities throughout the country, offering certificate certification programs on urban and rural community policing. So folks will have this ongoing continuing education related to some of those issues that we're seeing facing in this country. So we're excited about the work at our institution. We remain committed in spite of COVID to be a thought leader in this country and providing solutions to some of the world's problems.
That is so awesome. And you touched on so many different initiatives, so many things that you're doing to be responsive to the community when we talk about healthcare and we talk about challenges as far as the COVID-19 response and the lack of giving more support for the hospitals that are understaffed and making sure that we have those key staff members in place. How are you guys handling, because this has been a recurring question for parents, for students, everyone thinking about the fall is about to start. I know that you guys do have an online program. How have you guys been handling that response in terms of how to ensure that the students are coming back to a safe environment? Some schools are doing high flex, some schools are doing hybrid, some schools are giving students options. Can you give us some tips or ways that maybe schools can think about that process and how you as a leader have managed to navigate the process of the decision making for your students?
Sure. I am very cautious in regards to giving instructions about a global pandemic that no one has answers to, right?
Sure.
And I think so often folks are giving their sort of ideology or perception. And once again, I preference it like this. Every institution, every organization is different. Every institution, sure, every organization is not created equal. And so what the dynamics are for me may be totally different from someone else. So what I will do is speak to what we have done at Claflin University and, you know, what we are following our practices. And so we have we incorporated a very inclusive process when all of this happened, and starting in February, we started hearing all of the rumbling about it, and end of February, early March, you know, then mid-March, we implemented this sort of a control matrix that, you know, let us know prior to evacuation. It was color coordinated to know if X amount of people in the state of South Carolina have been affected by the virus, you know, this would happen. If this amount of folks were in our county, if this amount of folks were in our city, based on color codes, would lead to our evacuation, our departing campus, and all of those things. So we follow that to the T. Was able to convert fully online in the spring because we've already had a very strong online platform. It's converted all of our courses to online and got students through the finish line, you know, that time. And so we spent, right after the semester was over, I appointed a 36-member task force of faculty, staff, students, and community members who all had a vested interest in the well-being of all constituents that we serve here at Claflin University. And I tasked each one of the task force, they were broken into three subcommittees, and to present me with a plan of action that if we fully reopen this fall 2020, what would that look like? What are some of the KPIs? What are some of the financial implications behind reopening fully in the fall residentially? And then the second one was a plan to, if we have a hybrid, you know, asynchronous, synchronous learning, part-time, you know, in the class, part-time, online. And the third one was if we had to go fully online for the fall. And so those plans were well thought out. Like I said, had amazing KPIs, had some performance indicators, had some really key financial indicators. And so it was good. I take my hat off to the team. Once again, everyone had a vested interest in presenting these plans. And so we worked through those and we presented a strategy that we thought would make sense. And so we had a plan of action for students to return, and we changed our academic calendar for that to students to return first of August, and first day of class being August the 10th, and ending before Thanksgiving and being done for the complete semester. And so we were ready. We had put all of our invested dollars in our PPE. We spent over millions in PPE preparation and ensuring our residence halls were in place, our cleaning supplies, our signage, sneeze guards, everything that was needed from there. Make sure we had the right protocols in place. But 2 weeks before that, you know, we would continue to follow national, state, and local trends. And what we found was we're in a rural area, and our local hospital had a sort of an influx in COVID cases and their beds. So their beds were over 100% capacity. And so because we're in a small town, the thought of bringing back a community, about 3,000 people, to a small community where the local hospital is already beyond capacity, we just didn't think that makes sense. And so we pivoted. So from outstanding faculty who have been able to be agile and adjust, I'm grateful to my staff for being stellar and being able to work through this sort of, I don't even want to call it a new normal, the normal for today, because I have faith that it will go back to even being better in the future, and our administration for being just vigilant and, you know, just committed to ensuring that our students and our faculty and our staff are safe. So I'm fortunate to be surrounded with a team and an outstanding board who gets it, and an alumni base that has wrapped their arms around us to ensure that, you know, we're doing what it takes to make sure Claflin only survives this, but to thrive through it as well.
Oh, for sure. Thank you so much for addressing that. And I really appreciate what you said about the fact that you're not giving a one-size-fits-all suggestion or recommendation, that every school has to look at their individual community and their students and what makes sense. So I'm glad that you were more than informative in that response, because that's definitely something to keep in mind, that everybody's situation is different. It sounds like you've really done a good job, along with your staff and everyone involved in the decision making, to do what's best in the best interest for the students and the community as well. So that's great to hear that. In talking about joining with community and the surrounding area and the responsibility in higher education for us to develop some of those connections and partnerships, talk to me a little bit about the partnership that you developed with Zoom. That was some huge news, and congratulations to you guys for having the first university partnership with Zoom, a $1.2 million partnership. Tell us a little bit about that. What was that partnership, or what is that partnership about, and how are you planning to partner up with Zoom to bring value and continue to do the good things you're doing there at your university?
Right. Great question. And part of it is we had a very fortunate to have a outstanding congressman who does a lot of work in on behalf of the citizens in the state of South Carolina. And our congressman was in conversations with the congressman from California, and they were just talking about needs for industry, Silicon Valley, and things of that magnitude. And what we noticed was there was a lot of, when people transitioned, there was a lot of things happening that required technology. And so when a conversation came up with our Congressman Clyburn, who was able to open that door and that relationship with Zoom to have conversations. And so it started off as a preliminary conversation, but we thought big in Zoom as well. We thought, how do we really scale this, right? You know, so first, as any organization, talk about internships. And we said, well, it's not enough. In this middle of this pandemic, let's think about not just internships, but lifelongships. Let's talk about a real partnership. Let's talk about how do we scale our learning platform? How do we have faculty in residence, faculty exchange program? How do we have Zoom employee exchange programs? And so we were able to create, a model with this relationship with Zoom, and we've been, you know, once again, it took a time for us to work through and strategize through it. But I think it's, once again, it's an opportunity for us to show a quality public-private partnership. You know, when you think about a company that's a public company and a relationship with a university and how it can be mutually beneficial. Not just from the financial piece from us, but what also what we bring to the table from Zoom. We want to prepare their future computer scientists. We want to prepare their future engineers. We want to be a place that feeds them that type of talent. But we also, too, want to be a place that we can, you know, showcase through our learning platforms that, you know, Zoom is an area that, you know, you can utilize that piece in this distance education. But also, too, thirdly, is that Zoom shows that they're committed to the African-American community and to an HBCU mission. And so we're excited about how do we continue to build on this relationship? How do we continue to and leverage it, you know, globally? You know, we have an issue with getting students that have in rural communities, been in a rural community, and how do we utilize Zoom's platform to really reach those students where they are, and how do we tie that to the academic enterprise? So we're excited about the early stages of this relationship, and we're thankful for Zoom and for them being committed to supporting an HBCU during this time. And one of Zoom's senior execs now will be joining our board, so we're excited about that type of thought leadership. Their COO will be joining our board as part of a relationship. And so that's what it, often I think, you know, we go into these things with a tunnel vision, but we as Claflin University and Zoom was very open to exploring this thing holistically, and here's what we're coming out of it with. So we're excited. We're excited and thankful to, once again, both Congressman Clyburn from here and the congressman from California for bringing us together with Zoom, and we're looking forward to what the future holds.
That's awesome, and congratulations. And congratulations for thinking big. I think that's also a testament to your leadership and your team, because, like you said, sometimes you might have one thing in mind and it might be like, okay, this is what we can do, but then why not? Sky's the limit, right? Why not think about what things you can do that'll be game changers, I guess you could say, and it sounds like that's what you did. Talk to me about, because you kind of alluded to this a little bit already, about the partnership with Zoom and treating them students in terms of maybe STEM students and students that they might not necessarily have access to or that might not have access to them. And overall, something that we talk about on the podcast all the time, I definitely always bring it up, is the idea that in higher education, you've been in higher education. I was doing my research, and I'm like, did he start in higher education when he was a baby? Because you've been in higher education for 16 years. Were you a toddler when you first had your first position?
No, it's 22 years this year.
Okay. 22 years. So you were in elementary school. I'm sorry.
I was a baby.
You were a baby. But that's the funny thing. After being in education myself for about actually less time than you, now I think about it, I actually haven't been in education as long as you have, only about 18 or 20 years for myself. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we think about is how in higher education we can improve outcomes. And one of the things for myself, I went to a PWI, I went to University of Florida, and one of the things that we think about in higher education is the fact that our Black students, nurses of color, typically don't have the same outcomes as students that are in the majority. So a lot of times the retention rates are lower. If we look at the stats, the graduation rates are lower. Talk to me about the HBCU experience. You have experience as working at Bethune-Cookman in a leadership position, obviously your leadership position now. Talk to me a little bit about the role of HBCUs and what the predominantly white institutions and traditional environments can learn from the HBCUs that have amazing outcomes. We see students that are coming out at higher rates with their degrees, that are going on to get their master's degrees and are functioning and thriving. And then in the rest of higher education, it seems that a lot of times the conversation centers on what we need to do better. So what do HBCUs do differently or better that higher education needs to model as a whole, just based on your own experience and what you've seen in initiatives maybe that you have implemented at your university?
Right. I think that's a good question. I think I consider myself remotely qualified to sort of address that. So yes, I started when I was born in higher education. but I am, this is year 22, and I've worked at, I attended PWIs for both bachelor's, master's, and doctorate, and worked at PWIs for the first 12 years of my career, and the last 11, I've been at HBCUs. And so I have a well-rounded experience of working at both HBCUs and PWIs and attending PWIs. And so I think it's, and there are some, unique factors both HBCUs and PWIs offer. But I will say this, when you talk about those success rates and students of color being a place where they can be successful and going through this whole, cognitive developmental stage of who they are and whose they are and exploring that, I will say HBCUs have been very intentional and strategic about embracing students for who they are, right? And so, no matter how they come in, it's helping them get to where they want to go. And so we talk about retention, overall student satisfaction, student engagement. That's infused into the culture of HBCUs. It's not a add-on, right? because the people are there typically because it's mission work. Most of our HBCUs were founded on, from different church-affiliated, Christian-based institutions. And so, our faculty are there because it's a labor of love. The faculty, your student's name. Their situation, you're not a number, right? You're not a, you come in, you're sitting in this large auditorium and you can get lost. And often as a student of color, you may not have you could still be a first generation at a large PWI, but you're lost, And so here at our HBCUs, we're intentional and our strategies are, and most of us, and I'll say here, like at Claflin, we hire to mission. We hire folks who believe in, not just getting our students to the finish line, but getting them through the finish line. And so nurturing them, challenging them, empowering them, motivating them. I fundamentally believe every student has the ability to learn, but it has to be in an environment that nurtures, that challenges, and that motivates. And that's what we do, right? You see, I'll use Claflin University, our successful graduation rates, our successful retention rates, our successful overall persistent rates as it relates to students who are first generation from lower socioeconomic backgrounds, and how we continue to be ranked nationally for all of those areas because that's who we are, right? So until our faculty are clear, they don't just come to teach a class. They come to help inspire these future global visionary leaders to be successful. And students spend 18 to 22% of their time in the class. So that means 78 to 82% of their time is outside the class. And if we're not educating students outside the class, we're missing the boat. And it just doesn't happen sitting in English 101, doesn't just happen sitting in Algebra 101. It happens when you're really engaging those students. And that's what HBCUs do. And it's proven, it's shown. If you look at the data, we're continuing to graduate the most African Americans that are in the, medical profession, that are in the law profession and the education profession, but we only enroll about 3% of the student population of higher education in this country, but graduate significantly more of the African American population that are in leadership positions in those. And so we continue to punch above our weight and continue to do the outstanding work that is there. And so, yep.
Hey everyone, this is Joe just reminding you to check out our website at www.edupexperience.com, where you can find and explore all of the content that we've released under the EdUp Experience brand, including multiple podcast series, EdUp Elites, EdUp Embedded, and EdUp Experts. You can also suggest topics or guests for our podcast. Then head over to YouTube, check out our channel, The EdUp Experience, and you're going to find that my amazing co-host, Elizabeth Leiba, has started a new web series called EdUp Unplugged, where she talks about racism in America with special guests coming on that web series. We've got a lot going on at The EdUp Experience. Again, check out our website at www.edupexperience.com. Now let's get back to our guest.
Where did that, and I have asked a couple of guests, and I'm still kind of wrapping my mind around that because I have a lot, I'm from Florida for the most part, even though I'm an immigrant and a first-generation student myself, but I went to University of Florida. I have a lot of friends that went to Florida A&M University, and they have a certain swag that I always kind of was like, you know, really envious of us, of that. Where does that come from? Do you think it's the mentorship? Do you think it's that they're seeing themselves reflected in the faculty? There's a lot of, and I talk about this all the time in my work as far as just advocating for Black faculty and some of the struggle that comes along with higher education really not paying as much attention to looking at leadership in terms of Black representation of Black leadership and Black faculty, things of that nature. But what do you think is being done differently in terms of the representation, and is it that the students need to see themselves reflected more in order for them to have that confidence? I think one of the guests we had previously talked about the fact that a lot of times the students just, there's so much microaggression that happens at the PWIs that by the time they get to grad school or go on for their doctorate, they're just so exhausted. So what role do you think actually seeing faculty and staff and other students in leadership positions, maybe that look like them, what role does that play in maybe that confidence that we should be able to or should try to instill in our students?
I mean, I think that's it. You know, I think until our PWIs are intentional about diversifying the faculty, diversifying the staff, diversifying the student body and their leadership, you know, you'll continue to have those challenges, right? And so you can't do these one-offs. There's a Black student union, there's a Black, you know, student association, and, you know, but where are the resources, right? You know, how we're engaging them, how we're connecting with those students, how do we make sure that we can retain faculty? You know, so my first 11 years at PWIs, that was a conversation. Oh, we can't get any African-American faculty to come here, right? Mm. But so I'll ask the question, where are you advertising?
Right. Okay.
Or are you recruiting, right? You know, like, so, you know, if you're serious about it, but I can say if you wanted faculty members in biology, you're going to some of the best biology programs, right? And so if you wanted the same thing with African-American faculty, you'll go to some of the programs that have a large amount of African-American faculty. So if it's a commitment, you will put the effort into doing it. And I think so often it doesn't happen. So that, I think that's why it comes where, because it's installed, it's a culture where you come to our campus on first day, we have a thing called matriculation day, we have parting day. We speak life into our students to let them know, like, that listen, you're here because you're supposed to be here, not because no one has given you anything, you've earned it. Like this year, we had over close to 10,000 applications, but when it took a class of 600. So we know that they're amongst the top of the top. Our mean GPA is a 3.65. So for them, that you are great, and we speak that, you know, and we challenge them to understand to walk that way. We have a thing called Claflin confidence. Students know that they leave here and they have this thing called Claflin confidence. They can compete with any student, wherever student. I'll use Christoph McFadden. You know, he was our SGA chaplain, and now he's on a full 100% fellowship paid to Harvard. And he's getting a phenomenal stipend that's there. But I say this, Christoph can go can go there and he will compete and outdo most of those folks that came from anywhere else that's at Harvard, because it's just what we install in our students here at our HBCUs. And I think it's hard for that to happen, because that's when I say higher admission, faculty believe that when they come here and they see those students, the staff, the administration, as the president, my students, majority of them know my cell phone number. Majority of them have my, but I'm intentional about that, right? Because I know what it takes to be able to feel nurtured. You know, people go to some of these other institutions, not, you know, and they don't even know who their president is. You know, they only see a person one time at commencement. And I think, you know, it's, oh, we're smaller. No, you just have to be intentional. And that's part of the culture, and that's what you get. And so that's why I tell students, depends on what you're looking for. The Claflin experience is not for everyone. And this is my second presidency. I was a college president for 5 years before coming here, in St. Louis at Harrisville State University, and now president here. And so I'm in my seventh year as a president. And so I'm fortunate, right? I've been, like I said, in my first 11 years we're at PWIs, and I've been recruited to, but this is my ministry. This is the work God has called me to do. And I can be my authentic self in this space and do what I'm called to do and be unapologetic about it. Right. You know, and so, that's who we are. And I think, but let me say this, we need more African Americans in leadership positions at PWIs. We need more African American faculty at PWIs. We need more African American staff at PWIs, because our students, wherever they go, they need to be nurtured. They need to be loved. They need to be challenged. And sometimes having someone else can't do that, but to have someone that looks like you, that you can inspire to be. And like, if I see this at the University of Florida, and if you matriculate through whatever your degree program was for 4 years and only saw one faculty member, the probability, African American faculty member, the probability of you really believing in your heart of heart that that's a profession you can go into will be slim, you know. But some folks are more, you know, self-motivated to think it. But if I see different faculty member in these different disciplines and really encouraging me and let me know that I can believe it, because I can see it. If I see it, I can believe it. So
I love that you said,
hope that makes some sense.
Oh, it makes perfect sense, because you spoke to me, and I G'd up and I wiped a tear, but I had a little tear coming down for a quick second, because when you said speak life into your students. On my first day at orientation, my parents are Jamaican, so they're immigrants and never went to college. And my first day of orientation at University of Florida, and I'm not telling anything that, you know, everybody knows it because we've all been through it, that went to University of Florida. They said, look left, look right. Neither of those students will be there at graduation. And I thought, oh, my gosh, you know, it's almost like, and like you just said, I did only have one Black faculty member. He taught African-American studies, and everybody on campus that was Black had him, because we all knew that was going to be your one shot to have a Black faculty member during your undergraduate years. So what you're saying makes plenty of sense. And
imagine the mental piece behind that, right? Like,
right.
If that's
right.
What you have to go through. And I think the difference is my orientation, we say the same thing. We say, hey, you know, at our matriculation day, at our pardon day, we tell parents and students, look to your right. And look to your left. You are your brother's, you are your sister's keeper. You're only going to be as successful as that person to your left or right. So if that person fails, you failed them. So it's imperative that when commencement comes 4 years from now, you're sitting right next to that person, because you did what it was necessary to do to uplift your brother or your sister to ensure that they finish the finish line as well. So it's a whole different narrative, right? You know, and so, it's imperative that we support each other to the finish line.
Absolutely. I love that philosophy. Tell me about your leadership, because when we're thinking about what we just discussed, the dearth of leadership as far as African-American leaders in the college institutions across the country, I see you're one of the youngest current college presidents. You've had decades of experience in higher education. A little birdie told me you're a member of Kappa Alpha Psi fraternity. So I said, oh, we're about to have some, Crimson and Cream Love on this podcast today, because I'm a member of Delta Sigma Theta Sorority Incorporated.
I hear you, my sister.
So let's think about leadership. What advice would you give for those that are working higher education, that are Black and want to aspire to leadership? And what would you say to those that are in the sphere of higher education and are hiring managers, or leaders, and what do they need to do to support the initiative to increase leadership in these areas as far as the faculty, the staff, and the administration?
Well, sure. I am, and anyone who knows me in this profession know me well, that I am not a, what you see is what you get. I'm not your traditional academician. I didn't come from, I am the epitome of first generation. Come from very low socioeconomic background. No one in my family ever went to college. And so I didn't come to this knowing the blueprint, right? You know, and so I was blessed to have some mentors that believed in me, challenged me, and pushed me. And so that's why I live by that mantra. But within that, I think it's, I believe in this whole notion, if we're not at the table, then we're on the menu. And so often when we get to the table, we are unwilling to challenge the status quo because we're just thankful for being at the table.
Okay. Oh, wow. Please say it louder for the people in the back. That was a whole word right there. Thank you so much for saying that.
I know, but it's imperative, though, right? I think we get there and we're okay, right? Because I've arrived, right? Mm-hmm. But if you're not helping someone else get there, you know, then we're missing the boat, right? You know, and so I think too often leaders are complacent and fearful because they're in this position, and if you know their families are eating good and they have these experiences and they've arrived. But you know, my philosophy has always been different. There's strength in numbers, and so the more we can get to the table, the more we can get leading, the more we can get transforming the social norms, the better. And so it does no good for me to be there if I can't help somebody else get there. And so I believe in real life mentoring. I believe in real life, you know, sponsorship, you know, because mentoring is, you know, if somebody can't put their name on you, then that don't waste your time. Oh, so-and-so is my mentor. Where do they know you? Well, it's not really your mentor, right? You know, and so who's going to sponsor you? Who's a real sponsor for you? And I think that too often we don't do that, right? And then, you know, leadership is tough, right? And so being in a leadership position, you know, it's not about popularity. It's not about pomp and circumstance. And so sometimes what happens, folks get in these positions and it becomes about them. And that's always my prayer, like, God, you know, always remove me. Let your will be done. And to be focused. I am student-centered, student-focused, student-driven. Everything I do is around that space, you know, because I wouldn't be where I'm at today if that didn't happen for me, right? I didn't come in prepared. I was a knucklehead. Nothing about school was cool to me. I was an athlete. That was my ticket out. But there was folks who believed in me when I didn't believe in myself. And so I owe it to people to do the exact same thing, right? My mentors have said, who sacrificed tons of things for me, and I still to this day ask them, like, what do I owe you? Only thing you owe me is to when you were in this position to do the exact same thing for someone else. And so now I'm at a position, I am required to do that. I have a responsibility to do it. And unfortunately, folks don't possess that confidence. And I think, my advice to folks, younger or older folks who are seeking leadership, don't seek it for the title or the position. Seek it for the real work, you know, because getting a position is one thing, but standing in it is another, you know, and then, you know, having the ability to sustain and be willing to make tough decisions, right? You know, and I think sometimes we get in these positions and unwilling to make those tough decisions or have courageous conversations about, you know, I would say at PWIs, right? I can speak to this because I was at them. And part of my challenge was I talked a lot, right? Like, so if you say to me, like, I'll never forget, I was at one PWI, and the question they asked me was, you know, Dr. Wormack, I have a question. And I'm like, oh, sure, you know. Can you tell me why all the African-American kids sit together in the cafeteria? Wow, I'm so glad you asked that. I said, sure. Can you tell me why all the white kids sit together in the cafeteria? It's like, I said, so what we're going to do is go in there tomorrow together, and we're going to look. And so at this time, the African-American population was less than 5% at this institution. So I said, you have to be looking very hard to see that, right? Because obviously that the folks are there, all of the other 13 tables are all white folks, right? You know, and so why aren't they sitting together? You know, I said, and so it was like, wow, I never thought about it like that. Mm-hmm. I said, so part of it is that if they're an only one in a class all day, as African-American students, they're only one. If 10 of them are there and one's a biology major, one's a psychology major, one's a, you know, sports management major, well, they don't see each other in class, right? So they're the only one. And so once, by the time they get to the cafeteria, this is their chance to be able to assimilate and be connected with folks who are like them. So not saying that's a bad thing or anything. Like I said, why do all the athletes sit at the table together? Why do all of the sorority folks sit at the table together? Mm-hmm. So it's about being connect who you have your connections with. I said, so it's not always about being a bad thing and being able to identify that. I said, so how many times have other folks gone to that table to separate it? And so after that conversation, it shifted the paradigm of this person who was a top leader at the institution. And but if I was afraid to have that type of conversation, the needle will never move, right? You know, and so I just think we have to, when we're in positions, we have to be a voice for the unvoiced. And being at the table is one thing, but being able to speak for others and speak truth to power is another thing.
I love that. How do we move that national needle? I saw your article, which was very informative about the duty and the responsibility and the mission to be able to lead national change. We all know in this post George Floyd murder era that our country is entering, that there's a lot more reflection and discussion about these national movements. What do you think is needed? And you talked about it a little bit more in depth in the article, but just briefly, can you give us like your top areas that you think that we need to, as individuals or even in higher education, what do we need to address in order to move that national needle?
Well, I think first off, admitting that there's a problem. Right. You know, I think that's it. One first step is admitting that there's a problem. And then once we admit that there's a problem, identify real, meaningful, tangible, measurable solutions to be able to resolve it. And so so clearly there is a problem with, as a in an article I talked about briefly on, you know, just understanding as a leader. Right. And so I've been very fortunate. I've done postdoc work at Harvard. I've seen the world from Germany to Ireland to you name it. I've done things I could never imagine as a poor kid coming from Detroit, Michigan. And so I'm in rooms with, I've gone to the White House numerous times. I've gone to meet the presidents. I've met governors and all of these different things. And right. But at the same time, none of that matters when I'm driving my car down the street. I'm still just an African-American male. Right. Mm-hmm. And when I'm put over, I receive the same treatment that someone that will receive is there. So I wrote about this, you know, early George Floyd. Like, I am George Floyd. I am Trayvon Martin. I am Jordan Davis, you know, because that's the reality that I live. Right. And I've, no matter how successful I am, I shared a story where I was, you know, executive vice president, and I was pulled over in my neighborhood, face down, gun to my head, said, what am I doing in this neighborhood? Why am I driving this type of car? And that I've purchased a home in that community that I belong in. Right. And then after the whole experience was over, oh, we're so sorry, Dr. Warmack. Well, I don't get that time back. Right. And, you know, like that experience is an experience that I experience, and that I don't get that experience back. And because I'm, quote, Dr. Warmack, the ideology or the conversation changes after you humiliated me and had me land face down in a puddle of water because I fit the description of someone that didn't belong in that neighborhood. And so we're admitting we have a real problem. And being willing to address the problem through courageous conversations, right? A lot of it is, you know, a lot of fear, and it's false evidence appearing real. So being able to create a space where folks can have meaningful dialogue, meaningful discussions, and being okay to agree to disagree, to be able to move the needle.
Wow, that's deep. And I thank you for being so transparent and sharing that experience. But you're right, people need to know the reality of what's happening, and until we can acknowledge that, we can't move forward. And I appreciate everything that you shared with us today. I could speak to you for another hour because you have so many gems of wisdom to share. So I'm so happy and honored that you joined us today. I want to be respectful of your time, and I definitely would love to have you come back on, because I just think you have so much, a vast wealth of knowledge that you can really share with us. So if you guys have anything that initiatives with different things that you're bringing out, and you continue to do the good work there. We definitely would love to have you back. But I want to wrap up by asking the last couple of questions that we normally ask. Okay. And you can answer these in any order that you feel comfortable with. The first one being, what do you see as the future of higher education, just based on your vast experience and just maybe serving as a futurist for us for a moment? And then is there anything that we missed, anything that you want to talk about that you're doing there at Claflin that you want to just toot your horn and let us know, anything that is up and coming for you guys there on campus?
Well, sure. The future of higher education. Well, first off, let me say thank you again for having
You're
me
welcome.
On the podcast.
I am
grateful. Thank you for your, I know this is, you know, once again, it's not a full-time job for you all. This is something as a labor of love, and mm-hmm. your professionalism, your ability to really work through the piece that was there and making me feel comfortable during this interview makes a world of a difference. So I just want to say thank you.
I appreciate that.
The other piece behind that is, you know, the future of higher education is, once again, is I've been talking about this probably about 10 years, is reimagining technology. And what COVID has done is made us fast forward faster, right? You know, and so how do we reimagine higher education in the sense of utilizing technology? I told my staff again today, the students that are entering this class, this fall of 2020 class, were born in the year 2002. They were born in the year 2002. So if you think about that from perspective, they're born into technology. They're born into the utilization of it. And so for us not to have engaged pedagogy strategies and our campus infrastructure, from bandwidth to all of those things that infuses technology into learning, we're behind eight ball. So fortunately, unfortunately, COVID has forced a lot of us across the board to really begin to look at, you know, that. And so what it also too is have us begin to explore curriculum. You know, is it still the traditional four-year experience, or do we look at CLEPing courses? Do we look at, you know, looking at courses that are, you know, work life experiences to be able to do that? How do we get more certificate certification programs and folks in industry to be able to get credentialed, stackable credentials for folks? So I just reimagining how we serve and service the student population that come in. And in Claflin, that's what we're doing. You know, we are wanting to be the thought leader and looking at all of those areas, from just not just online, but how do we engage students in a traditional format, and is hybrid education methodology of delivery a way of not the future but the way of now? You know, and how do we ensure that, once again, an old jug to mug faculty member standing in front of class delivering a message, you know, to ensure that learning has happened. So we're exploring all of those, you know, those areas, and ensuring that we want to be one of the thought leaders. But I will say this, whether it's HBCU or PWI, institutions across the higher education across the country is doing everything in their power. My colleagues at both HBCUs and PWIs, you know, I think the critical mass of all of my colleagues is the commitment to the student and doing what is in the best interest of their institutions to ensure that they're successful and safe. And so I just take my hat off to all of my colleagues at every type of institution, specifically our HBCUs as well, though, you know, who are been, you know, conditioned to be able to do more with less and continue to do outstanding jobs. So I encourage them. I send love from a distance, you know, and just pray that everyone, you know, has a successful fall semester, and God covers them, you know, and the students that we serve, for them to have a safe and healthy experience.
Hope you enjoyed that episode. To learn more about the EdUp Experience, please visit edupexperience.com. And if you want to be in on the live recordings, please sign up for our email list. Go to edupexperience.com and sign up to be a subscriber. We'll let you know how you can listen in live and get the scoop before anyone else does. So please, as always, feel free to share this podcast, rate, review, and subscribe. We would really, really appreciate that. You've been listening to The EdUp Experience, where we make education your business, with your hosts, Dr. Joe Salustio, Elizabeth Liva, and Elvin Freitas.